All right, so this is the second session on the Reformation. And just to recap, on the first session, we saw how quickly things became formalized and organized. That which was originally what we read in the New Testament, more organic, and where local churches were more or less autonomous, and the apostles, like the Apostle Paul said, we don't have dominion over your faith. Now, that approach, attitude, and understanding quickly disappeared off the scene very quickly in succeeding generations. And we saw that there was a rise of a clerical hierarchy that sought to be a guardian of orthodoxy right across the Mediterranean, the Middle East, in all the churches. And even before Constantine, we saw how they would reprimand other churches or even try to excommunicate them or call them heretics. So that was already in motion. That model was already developing before Constantine and was ready for the time of Constantine. So when Constantine, as it were, in inverted commas, converted to Christianity and wanted to make Christianity the religion of the state, there was already a unified, organized, recognizable body that represented, in inverted commas, the church. And into the Roman Empire, they were in all brought in. There was, as I said, there was this union of church and state working in tandem. And the church at the time of Constantine was ready to be recognized as one solid unit. And who knows, like I said, what other Christians there were, even at that time, meeting in homes outside of this organized unit that got incorporated into the state system and patronized by the state system and by the state's power, to the extent that the Catholic Church emerging would use state power, its physical power, to persecute others who differed in opinion from what they considered the Orthodox Catholic faith. And in the 5th century, the Roman Empire disintegrated. But as I mentioned, the Roman Catholic Church remained an emerging European power, so that in about the 9th century, a Holy Roman Empire started to take place with a guy called Charlemagne. And it's interesting. It depends when you want to officially date the beginning of what is called the Holy Roman Empire. But it's from about 9th century and it went till the 19th century. So depending when you date it, it lasted either about 900 years or 1,000 years. And of course, it was Catholic and continued to brook no disagreement with its doctrine or practice. And we know that it persecuted viciously and cruelly all those who wanted to digress from its doctrine and practice. And before we come to the 16th century itself, I think it's really helpful to understand the background that the 16th century, with the reformers, Martin Luther, someone called Huldrych Zwingli and John Calvin, they were by no means the first to say what they were saying at the beginning. There was a movement that began in the 12th century in France, they say by someone called Peter Waldo, and from him the Waldensians emerged, that movement. its particular emphasis was voluntary poverty. So I'm not sure if they still had a flavor of a Catholic aspect about them. But because of the scarcity of their writings, it's difficult to absolutely pinpoint all their beliefs. However, many of their teachings anticipated those of the later reformers, some 300 years later. They rejected the use of indulgences, paying for forgiveness, in other words. Baptism was to be by full immersion in water and was not administered to infants. Eventually, they taught that the bread and the wine were to be understood as symbols only. So they didn't believe in transubstantiation, where the bread and the wine literally turns into the body and blood of the Lord. They also rejected the notion of purgatory, which Martin Luther didn't for years. Even in 1517, he didn't. They taught against prayers offered for the dead, and they accepted the Bible as the sole total authority of all doctrine. So they opposed the superstitious beliefs and practices of the Catholic Church with regards to relics, bits of bones of so-called state, Lent and fasting, and pilgrimages. They rejected what they perceived as the idolatry of the Catholic Church and considered the papacy as the Antichrist of Rome. I went through that catalogue because this reads like the catalogue of the objections of the reformers, and it's some 300 years before. But what happens here, they have no political state power behind them that they can wed to or that would support them. So we can see that this brought them inevitably into conflict with the Catholic Church. And by 1215, the Waldensians were declared heretical and subjected to intense, terrible persecution over a long period of time, with many being burnt at the stake by the Catholic persecutors. And this led them to spreading to many different parts of Europe. Although they survived, their existence was a very precarious one. But at the time of the Reformation, some of their representatives met with representatives from the Reformation, and they merged and accommodated their own statement of belief to that of the reformers so that they could worship more freely and more publicly. So we can see that the abuses, false teaching and superstitions of the Catholic Church that the reformers argued against and exposed had already been opposed and attacked by the Waldensians some 300 years earlier. And then in the next century, the 14th century, we have John Wycliffe in England. And without going through the whole list again, many of the points that I have just listed of the teachings of the Waldensians, John Wycliffe picks them up, inveighing against the corruption, immorality, and exploitation of the Catholic Church. The Archbishop and the bishops were hopping mad at this. So why wasn't he immediately burnt at the stake? Now, this is where it gets very telling and relevant. The Catholic Church, I read, owned one third of the land in England, paid no taxes. Revenues were paid to the papacy. He was saying the papacy is invalid, has no scriptural warrant. He said things, the Catholic Church is so corrupt that its possessions, clerical possessions, buildings should be disendowed from them. And who gets the benefit? The state should take over their possessions. So his reforms, as far as they went against Catholic superstitions and obvious abuses, had the support of English nobility, particularly one called John of Gaunt, who was the father of a future King of England. And they supported him against the onslaught and protestations of the Catholic Church. Now, it's very interesting. He, in the end, lost this strong support. For why? Because he went on to attack the Eucharist, transubstantiation, the idea that the body and blood of the Lord, the bread and wine literally turn into those, into the body and blood of the Lord. Once he did that, the nobles, being religious, were religious in the sense that they thought this is going too far. You know, this has been the tradition of the church. This is, you know, the sacrifice of the Lord. And they wouldn't support him now. But they kept him from the worst onslaught of the Catholic Church, to ban him, to imprison him. But he was required to retire to Lutterworth, to a former rectory of his, and he lived out his days. But later, at the so-called Council of Constance, a Catholic council which did a number of things, one of them trying to resolve the problem of having three popes at the time, but it also denounced John Wycliffe as a heretic. And at that, the then king of England, who was, I think, Henry VI, they got him to get John Wycliffe's body exhumed and burnt at the stake. But what we have emerging here is what I wanted to indicate right at the beginning under Constantine. Here you have the secular power, the religious secular power. In the end, when push comes to shove, he who has the more might dominates. And during the time of John Wycliffe, the nobility in England was strong enough to keep at bay the Catholic onslaught of John Wycliffe. Now, how much was religious conviction in this nobility? How much was political expediency in retrieving wealth and power from the Catholic Church and investing it in the state again? That is a matter of debate, but no doubt both religious conviction and political power play was at work. But here we see also the secular side, religious side, deciding how far you can go in changing doctrine. When he wanted to attack the mass, the Catholic mass, the nobility, then said, no, this is going too far. So they were also deciding what should be acceptable and not acceptable as doctrine. And this continues that sort of Constantinian model, or as one historian has said, the sacralist model. And all these things are relevant and decisive with the emergence and success of the Reformation. Just briefly to mention one more person, Jan Hus, or John Hus, leader of who were called the Hussites. He again was in agreement with what the Waldensians were saying. In fact, he was greatly influenced by John Wycliffe. The Catholic authorities were quick to have him burnt at the stake. But in the area, sort of central Eastern Europe of Bohemia, there was a large following there. That's the area of Good King Wenceslot that we sing. It's that area. Now, that following of the Hussites resulted in the Hussite Wars that lasted nearly 20 years. They rebelled against Catholic authority and rose up in arms against the Catholic authority. And the walls devastated that region. There's some have estimated maybe more than 1 million people were killed in those wars. And the region was absolutely devastated. So what kind of people were they? We don't rightly know. The Hussites could see through the Catholic superstitions. You just have to read the Bible with common sense to realize that many of the teachings were bogus. The question is, does that make you an evangelical? Does that make you a converted person? Does that make you a Christian? You can have a change of mind about doctrinal outlook and reform. Does that necessarily mean that the person has had a change of heart inwardly? Why the Waldensians didn't fight, the Hussites did. Jesus said, "For all they that take the sword shall perish by the sword." Did these budding reformers not read this? Did they not understand this? "If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight. But now is my kingdom not here. It's not from here." Did the Hussites not understand this? Did even the reformers, Zwingli, Luther and Calvin, not understand this? Why did they take arms against dissenters to destroy them? It's a fundamental question. Did they understand the gospel? Or was there just a change in outlook? So why did the reformers like Luther, Zwingli and Calvin succeed when others have failed? And I want to mention 4 points which I think are fundamental, and I've been quite encouraged. I've done general reading, and I've continued that general reading to make sure what I'm sharing with you is not just off some Joe's blog, but comes from historical sources. And I've been encouraged to find that the notes I've made have been reiterated, substantiated by wider reading that I've done. I'll mention 4 reasons why the Reformation succeeded in budding and blossoming in the 16th century rather than previously. Number one, the Catholic powers themselves were preoccupied with fighting one another. I mean, it's almost laughable. You've got the Holy Roman Empire, which wasn't holy, which wasn't Roman, and which wasn't an empire. Basically, the Holy Roman Empire strictly consisted of Central Europe, mainly the Germanic-speaking areas, that hadn't formed into one nation state as France and Spain had done. But England was Catholic. France was very Catholic, but had accrued to itself a certain autonomy with regards to the Holy Roman Empire, though it was aligned with it. Spain was very Catholic, but the King of Spain was also inaugurated as the Holy Roman Emperor as Charles V. And these big powers were caught up in what were called the Italian Wars from the end of the 15th century right to the middle of the 16th century. And they were a series of violent wars for control of territories in Italy, fought largely by France and Spain, but involving the Pope and much of Europe and also England. In 1521, that's just 4 years after Martin Luther pinned his 95 Theses up, The Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, allied with England and the Pope. They allied against France, who wanted to get land for himself in the Italian territories. But he was defeated and he was captured. That's Francis I, King of France. And in 1525, he was forced to sign a peace treaty while he was imprisoned. Then, however, when he was released, Francis I denounced the treaty because it had been signed under duress. Now, the Pope thought, my Holy Roman Emperor Charles V is getting too powerful, too big for his boots. So the Pope joined now in an alliance with the King of France and with England against Charles V. Now, in the resulting war, Charles' mercenary troops sacked and plundered Rome itself, and the Pope came under virtual imprisonment in 1527. This is right at the time when the Reformation is emerging. They're all fighting each other. It was during this time, by the way, that King Henry VIII asked the Pope for an annulment of his marriage to Catherine of Aragon. Now, Catherine of Aragon, of course, was the aunt of the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, who had the Pope imprisoned, in virtual imprisonment at that time. So there's no way, whatever other reasons there might have been, there's no way that the Pope was going to sign a declaration to annul King Henry VIII's marriage to the aunt of Charles V, who was holding this Pope under virtual imprisonment. I mean, it was a mess. It was a mess. And those Italian wars went on for 50 years. And of course, then you had the Ottoman Empire coming from the east, also occupying the mind of the Holy Roman Empire. The second important reason that facilitated the Reformation was, as we have mentioned, the wealth, corruption, and exploitation of the Roman Catholic Church. The papal court, almost famous as a hotbed of conspiracies, plots, and intrigues, plagued with immorality. In a pastoral letter shortly before the Reformation, one bishop complained of the immorality of many priests who openly kept concubines and mistresses in their houses, who refused to dismiss them, who brought them in secretly, who gambled, who sit in the taverns with laymen, drink to excess, utter blasphemies, etc., etc. I mean, their sort of immoral living, high living, was well known throughout Europe, and Luther testified to those things himself. Towards the end of the 15th century, in one region of southern Germany, about 1,500 children in one diocese were born annually to Roman Catholic so-called celibate priests. And the church condoned their behavior by exacting a cradle fee for each child and a mistress fee from each offending clergyman. And the indulgences were much peddled at that time because the popes were really vast amount of money were spent on building works in Rome. So that would be the second reason. They were bringing themselves into disrepute, being very rich, being very uncaring and exploiting, and the powers in Europe, territories, were beginning to sort of get unhappy about the state of affairs and, if you like, want a bit of a bigger slice of the cake. The third reason, which again is, I think, another decisive factor is what is called Renaissance humanism. Very complicated. I've tried to read up on it, to put it succinctly, but very difficult. It occurred during, well, the during the 14th, 15th, and 16th century. Now, but Renaissance humanism was not anti-Christian at all, like humanistic teaching today. On the contrary, Christian humanists wanted to bring the clear teaching of the Bible to the people. Their efforts were towards making society more moral, more Christian, more cultured, and to bring advance in every area of life, scientific, artistic, cultural, religious, moral, etc. To put it briefly, it was a movement that saw the traditional mode of teaching and learning of previous centuries as a straitjacket to free thinking. Particularly, they wanted to be free from the dogma of the church, which had determined so much learning in the previous centuries. Renaissance humanism advocated, emphasized, and applied a return to the reading of Greek and Latin classical literature, and without blinding us with any more science, with regards to our focus, what was an essential part of the Christian humanist approach was referring back to ancient sources, ancient texts. This was a major thrust of humanistic research and teaching, and this means ancient biblical sources. Let's get back to what the scriptures say and teach, not what tradition dictates, was a kind of drumbeat of the Christian humanists. Now, this brings us to one person in particular called Erasmus, who you may have heard of, a leading, decisive figure in the 16th century, religious and otherwise. He was a Catholic priest, remained a Catholic priest, and remained in the Catholic Church, but a very notable scholar. And all the major reformers, whose names you might know, and those maybe that you don't know, were influenced either by him or by Renaissance humanist teaching. Erasmus gathered together Greek manuscripts of the New Testament and eventually published a Greek New Testament in 1516, 1 year before Martin Luther puts his 95 Theses up. Now, his Greek New Testament, there are further editions of them, and a future edition of this became the basis for the Textus Receptus, the received text on which the King James Authorized Version of the Bible is based. Erasmus writes in 1516, "If the gospel were truly preached, the Christian people would be spared many wars." And he was a very peace-loving man. In the end, he didn't go with the reformers. Erasmus labored throughout his career to furnish Christians and the reformers with the tools for scriptural analysis and research upon which to build both criticisms of the church and challenges to false doctrine. The Bible becomes the standard by which to judge doctrine and practice. This was the Renaissance humanist thrust before the reformers appear publicly on the scene. Again, Erasmus writes in 1516, "I am delighted to know that my labors, such as they are, find some favor with men of goodwill. Many are taking this opportunity to read the scriptures who would never have read them otherwise, as they themselves admit." So in their approach, Erasmus and other Christian humanists and theologians paved the way for the reformers that followed. They provided a platform, an impetus, and an input into the thinking of emerging reformers. So Erasmus found himself caught between two. The Catholics were saying, you're a reformer, you're a traitor, you're a heretic. Now, at this time, just after 1516 now, Luther, who had been educated along these lines, and there was places like Paris, like Basel and Switzerland, they became centers of learning. Even the King of France, he was drawn to Renaissance humanism and let it flourish until in the end it flourished so much in France that reformist doctrines erupted in placards, in protests in France itself, and he had to quash them. Caused persecution, but it had effect pan-European, this Renaissance humanist movement. So, and Luther was in correspondence with Erasmus saying, come on, why are you hesitating? Join us, join us. He wanted this big fish to join them. Erasmus held back. He wanted reform from within the Catholic Church. Also, he felt that the way the reformers were going was excessive and rather too turbulent and violent. And we'll be looking at some quotes later. But all this is to show the influence of Christian humanistic teaching of Renaissance that had on all the reformers. And what I want to highlight, as I've mentioned before, you don't need to have spiritual insight, spiritual revelation. You don't need to be a theologian to see that some Catholic teaching was bogus and superstitious. You just needed to read the scriptures in an unprejudiced way and see what they said. So what I'd like to bring to our minds is that just because you reform your doctrine, it doesn't mean you've had a revolution on the inside of you spiritually. That's the thing. And that crucial difference is a difference we will see in how the reformers behaved in persecuting those that dissented against them. It wasn't just Erasmus who had an influence on the leading reformers to come. There was a guy in France, in Paris, called Lefebvre. And now he was a French theologian and a leading figure in French humanism. It says in history books he was a precursor of the Protestant movement in France. Although he anticipated some ideas that were important to the Protestant Reformation, like Erasmus, Lefebvre remained a Roman Catholic throughout his life and sought to reform the church without separating from it. Luther used Lefebvre's commentaries on the Psalms and Romans in his lectures. And it was Lefebvre who helped Luther reconceive his ideas on justification by grace alone. That's according to one writer anyway. Now, one Catholic critic of the emerging reform movement said this: Luther is a great heretic, but Lefebvre is the master and Luther the disciple. Now that's interesting. It shows this connection and how we've already seen centuries before, people saw through the bogus superstition of the Catholic Church. The Renaissance movement gave a intellectual, scholastic, theological framework and platform, springboard for these thoughts, which was part and parcel of a wider humanistic people that humanistic approach that people across Europe were embracing, this liberty of thinking, of a freer thinking, to make advances right across every aspect of society. They were embracing it. And one of the seeds in it was Christian humanism. And so it was very much gave impetus, platform, and a seedbed for the Reformation. Again, this Catholic critic said, he names them all, Lefebvre, Erasmus, Luther, Melanchthon, Oecolampadius. These are all great reformers. He says they are all of the same ilk. No difference. It's very interesting. You had Catholics who could see through the abuses and false teachings of the Roman Catholics, who stayed in the Catholic Church. The reformers separated from them. How different they were is an interesting question. Does Reformation mean regeneration? The final, the fourth factor that allowed the Reformation to sprout was the growing sense of nationalism and independence of European states, territories, and regions. Europe wasn't like it is today with very identifiable large nation states. The Central Europe was a patchwork of duchies, principalities, city-states, kingdoms. It was a real hodgepodge. But for me, the growing independence and flexing of muscles of some of these kingdoms and states is one of, if not the most deciding factor. Because resentment against the Catholic Church and its abuses had been around for a long time, as we've already seen. Many had risked and given their lives in opposing Catholic doctrine. They hadn't succeeded because in the end, Catholic power was too prevalent and strong. And any such individuals or movements were brutally suppressed. What aided the Reformation was that certain ruling city councils in Switzerland and some princes in the German lands were now ready and in a position to support and protect the emerging Reformation. Their motives for doing so, however, were at least to some extent mixed. It was not that men like the reformers were more courageous in the 16th century to stand up for truth against the Catholic Church. Not at all. In fact, as we shall see, the leading reformers compromised the truth and even their own stated to allegiance to sola scriptura, which means the scriptures alone. They compromised sola scriptura when they themselves actually came up against the power of the religious state, the authority, the religious authority, not the Catholic Church, the secular religious authority that was patronizing them. Once the Reformation was underway, there was a conference in 1526 between the emerging Protestant states and the Catholic Church. And a significant phrase was coined. In translation from the Latin, it reads, whose realm? His religion. So the Protestant German princes were saying, look, it's our realm, our kingdom. We have chosen Protestantism. You Catholic regions, we're not touching you. You can keep your religion, but don't attack us. Let's have a policy. Whose realm? His religion. So you go back to Constantine. The dominant secular power decides what Orthodox Christianity is. And what I've just been saying to you, even today in Britannica, it confirms the same things, that this shifting of power within Europe, the various kingdoms, territories, city-states, republics, were viewing the wealth and corruption of the Catholic Church and thinking, hey, there was a growing sense of identity that wanted a slice of this power and of this wealth. And it would be difficult to argue against the notion that these powers align themselves with reformers in their religions as a pretext and means of disinheriting, disendowing the Catholic Church in their areas, taking over monasteries, etc., 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 not sending revenues to the papacy. However, it would be difficult to determine how much was religious conviction and how much was political expediency that led a regional power to support Reformation doctrine in its area. So in particular, the two areas where the Renaissance was allowed to take root was Germany initially and Switzerland, more or less about the same time. In Germany, tensions already existed between German princes and the Holy Roman Emperor. Jockeying for power and authority was already a feature in Europe in the 16th century. And German princes were ready to flex their muscles at this time. The Prince Elector Frederick III of Saxony, a region, a kingdom in Germany. Now, he had vied to be Holy Roman Emperor, as had Francis I, of King of France, as King Henry VIII. They all vied to be Holy Roman Emperor a bit earlier on. But the King of Spain, Charles, who became Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, he bribed them all, and he became Holy Roman Emperor. But he probably had a better claim to be a Holy Roman Emperor than the others. But here, who was the patron? Why couldn't the Catholic Church quash and crush Martin Luther? It was because of Prince Frederick III of Germany. He took him under his wing. He took the budding Reformation under his wing and had enough power to, at that time, to stop the objections, the edicts of Rome, the diets that were being held. He supported Luther, hid Luther and protected Luther. Without his support, Luther probably would have been dead and buried like those before him. In Switzerland, what had happened in Switzerland was, or there was a Swiss confederation of 13 regions or cantons, and their soldiers were used as mercenaries over a long period of time in Europe. And at one stage, a war flared up that developed into a major flaw, even with the imperial forces. But through certain complications, which we won't go into, the Swiss won the battle and gained for themselves total autonomy from imperial forces and from Rome. They were within the Holy Roman Empire, but they could choose their destiny. They could choose their religion. And that's from 1499. So when Zwingli appeared in Zurich, the council could say, by vote, we agree with Zwingli, we're going the reformist way. And there was nothing the Catholic Church could do about it. It was this factor, and I would say this factor alone, that allowed the Reformation to take root in Switzerland. It was the shift of power. Well, everything together. It was the shift of power, the emerging territorial powers in Europe flexing their muscles. It was Rome's own abuse of its situation. It was Renaissance humanism thrusting forward theologically, giving reputation to these reforms. And it was the actual princes and city-states or city-councils who then had authority to protect the Reformation in their regions. And that was, they are the four issues that allowed the Reformation to take root. I want to begin our look at the Reformation in Switzerland with this guy called Zwingli, Ulrich Zwingli. You might not have heard of him, but if you look at the history of the Reformation, any book, the big three, Martin Luther, Zwingli, and John Calvin. And Zwingli in Zurich, Reformation becomes a center in Zurich through Zwingli in Switzerland. The two Reformation movements in Germany and in Switzerland never merged. Why didn't they merge? They tried to merge, but Zwingli was in dispute with Martin Luther, mainly over the Eucharist. For Zwingli, Martin Luther was still too Catholic in his interpretation of the bread and the wine. And others joined in, other reformers joined in to, for some kind of compromise, but it could not be reached. So the Swiss Reformation stayed a separate movement to the German Reformation, and largely because of Zwingli. So we've got a little time to, we're going to look at the Reformation in Zurich, in Switzerland. So all these factors have played their part. And along comes Zwingli. He's a Catholic priest. And already before being a Catholic priest, he had been to the University of Basel and come under humanistic teaching, where there, one of the theologians was already criticizing these practices that we are now well versed in, that I've rehearsed. So he was definitely already under humanistic teaching, not just with regards to Catholic practices, superstitious in nature, but also in the system of learning, going back to Latin and Greek literature. And he spent several years in Basel and was deeply influenced by Renaissance humanism before he started as a priest. But he started as a priest in 1516 and became convinced that the Bible was had supremacy over all books. It was during his stay there at Glarus as a priest that he became acquainted also with the writings of Erasmus, and his library was full of humanist books, and he started to correspond with Erasmus. But in 1516, he moved to a place called Einsiedeln, just, I think it's about south, not far from Zurich, to a Benedictine abbey, which was quite famous, and is even today, I think, a location of pilgrimage because of the Black Madonna there, and pilgrims come, and reputed miracles had taken place. But anyway, he was placed there and preached there, and he continued his studies, concentrating on the epistles of St. Paul, and further developing his criticisms of the Catholic Church. And by this time, Zwingli had resolved to preach nothing but what the scriptures taught. And afterwards, he stated later that his evangelical understanding of the scriptures had already formed during this transition period when he was at Einsiedeln. And he developed a style of expository preaching, teaching from the biblical text itself, rather from the set lessons laid down by Catholic custom. Because this is something totally new for people to listen to. And people were coming because of pilgrimages that were being made. People were coming to Einsiedeln, to this Benedictine abbey, and he made a huge impact on these people. So much so that he was invited to be priest preacher at the Great Minster in Zurich itself. In 1519, he had read Luther, but he maintained that he had already discovered evangelical principles by then, by 1519. And in January 1519, he was to take up this position in Zurich. But during the sort of application period in December of 1518, a good friend got alongside to him and said, look, a rumor is going round that you have seduced the daughter of a high-ranking Zurich official. Well, this made Zwingli indignant. He was really indignant. He wrote, I cannot ignore such slander. Now, why was he indignant? He explained, she wasn't the daughter of a high-ranking Zurich official. She was the daughter of a barber. And he didn't seduce her. He proudly stated that he had made the decision never to deflower a virgin, a married woman, or a nun. And he proudly protested that he had kept resolutely to that. He confessed that while he was a priest in Glarus, the previous parish, he had, as he put it, fallen off the wagon. But he had decided to not do that again. Unfortunately, he said, when he got to Einsiedeln, he did fall off the wagon again. But his reaction to what was said to him was one of just indignancy, that he had kept himself very discreet. He actually boasted. No one knew about his indiscretions, not even his close friends. You might remember I said that in the diocese, which I think included Zurich, 1,500 children were born to priests in 1 year. It was very, very common because of their vow to celibacy. And so it was no unusual thing, and it didn't stop him being appointed to the Great Minster in Zurich. I want to pause. I'm puzzled. Does reformation mean regeneration? He says in 1519 he'd already developed his evangelical principles that, you know, we're not justified through penance, through indulgences, through good works. It's justification is by faith. Does a change in your doctrinal outlook, is that equated with regeneration? He showed no repentance, contrition whatsoever. There's nothing written subsequent to this. There's nothing written that he was indiscreet again. And he did get married a few years later. But where is the testimony of a conversion, of repentance, of this is how I was? We will read about one of the radical reformers who was persecuted by Zwingli, who testified to a conversion. But where was his testimony that he'd been on a wrong path and God had put him on a right path? This replicates itself with all the reformers, this kind of thing. Anyway, he is Zwingli. He's instituted in the Great Minster in Zurich. In 1519, in January, gives his first sermon, and again he deviates from the prevalent practice of basing a sermon on the guest gospel lesson of a particular Sunday, and using Erasmus's New Testament as a guide, begins to read from the Gospel of Matthew, giving his interpretation during the sermon. Mind-blowing for the listeners. In his sermon, he used exhortation to achieve moral and ecclesiastical improvement, which were goals comparable with the reforms of Erasmus. I'll just make a note here, but we've come back to this in a much bigger way. This is what I've copied from a history book. In his sermons, he used exhortation to achieve moral and ecclesiastical improvement in his congregation. From all the books I have read, I agree with this. I wondered and wondered, Calvin, Luther, whoever, what's going on here? There was no what I would like to call evangelical preaching. This sacralist mentality, this Constantinian model and mentality continue right through down to the reformers, where your parish is Christian by definition. I would say Christianized. So you don't start evangelizing them, saying, look, you've been in darkness. You need to repent, to know a true repentance of heart and a new life and a regeneration. They preached to their congregations as though they were Christians whose moral standard need to be raised. You must stop getting drunk. You must stop your swearing, etc., etc., etc. Did they know the gospel in their hearts in a way that resulted in them preaching the gospel, leading to a repentance in their listeners, where they didn't have to spend years, as we shall see, years trying to persuade the authorities and their congregation to accept reforms to Catholic practice and dogma? They were, I would say, further Christianizing a Christianized people rather than preaching the gospel that causes a spiritual renewal or a revival. This contrast we will see between the reformers and those that they persecuted, who we will call Anabaptists, the Swiss Brethren, or radical reformers. Zwingli attacked monks, accusing them of indolence and high living, and he increasingly preached against Catholic teaching and practices. In 1521, 2 years later, Zwingli was dissatisfied with the Catholic episcopal control over Zurich, so he resigned his post from them and was reinstated in the same church with a new authorization from the city council. And there's nothing the Catholic Church could do about it. I'm wondering whether to stop there. I think it seems like a good place to stop. It's a natural division, because what follows is when we really come, for me, to the meat of the matter. Finally, what the reformers actually believed and what the others who started with them but diverted from them and preached something more and something different. People who went into the highways and byways from door to door, created house groups, preached in fields, preached in homes, in a way not hundreds but thousands were converted through evangelistic preaching. Who persecuted them? Zwingli. It's an amazing scenario. So we'll stop there.